But the major responsibility for what's happened to the family rests on Lord Marchmain. He fails as a father. He is not there to raise his children. He turns and he runs. And there can be little doubt that part of the problem that Sebastian is facing, and I don't mean to get into psychology here, and I'm not playing the trick that Collins plays, is simply that he's had no father around. There has been no male principal at Brideshead. It hasn't been there for him. Bridie Older probably got a sense of it. But all the way through this novel, there are no fathers. Charles has a father at home, and it's as bad as if his father was off somewhere. Charles' father may be at home, but Charles' father isn't home. And that incredibly eccentric portrait of Charles' father is just bizarre, based apparently upon Waugh's own father. And apparently is a portrait of something of what happened to Waugh's father and what he became like. Bottom of page 24, Charles arrives at Oxford. I had been warned against the dangers of these rooms by my cousin Jasper, who alone, when I first came up, thought me a suitable subject for detailed guidance. My father offered me none. Son going off to the university and the father, no guidance, no words, nothing, nothing. Curiously, we find Cousin Jasper saying on page 25, I suppose this is the time I should give you advice. I never had any myself except once from your cousin Alfred. Cousin Jasper's father gave him no advice when he went off to Oxford. There are no fathers here. Remember that Anthony Blanche has a stepfather. We have no idea where Anthony Blanche's father is. Throughout this whole novel, the men have deserted. They have deserted their families. They've quit. Or, and it's in one sense, it's even worse in Charles's case, bottom of 39. Sebastian is saying, I don't want you to meet my family. I'm afraid you're going to meet my family. And finally, I don't keep asking you a question about your family. Well, neither do I about yours. Well, you look inquisitive. Well, you're so mysterious about them. I hoped I was mysterious about everything, says Sebastian. Perhaps I am rather curious about people's families. You see, it's not a thing I know about. There is only my father and myself. An aunt kept an eye on me for a time, but my father drove her abroad. My mother was killed in the war. Oh, how very unusual. She went to Serbia with the Red Cross. Charles's mother just takes off at some point, obviously not able to live in the house anymore, and goes out to Serbia working with the Red Cross. Please notice the parallel. That's what Cordelia goes off. She works with the ambulance in Spain. And at the end, Julia and Cordelia are together, both off nursing. A memory of Charles's mother that we don't learn much about her, but that link gets made through the novel. The aunt who was driven off, we learn about. Who could live in the house with that eccentric man? At the dinner table, he's not there. Conversations with him take place at one remove. He can't hear what's being said to him. He doesn't respond in human ways. Just truly, truly bizarre. And a sense all the way through that even down to, and I will take a moment to look at this, the description of the meals that get served. The aunt, before he drives her out, leaves 10 menus, and they just have them over and over and over again. And at one point, Charles's father says, well, I suppose we could have something else. We'll have lobster, we'll have lobster tomorrow. And Hayter, get lobster for tomorrow. The meal ends, they're going, and the father says, Hayter, you haven't ordered those lobsters yet, have you? Hayter says, no, sir. He says, well, don't. There is that complete remove even from those joys of life. And that's part of why Charles at the beginning is a failed young man. He's grown up in that dead, empty, lifeless, loveless, bleak home in which there has not even been a sense that God created a world full of delightful things and glorious things. that Catholic sense that because it will take bread and wine and water and transform them into eternal, lasting things, teaches us that the things of the world can be beautiful. They are here for our use. We cannot be attached to them. They will go. But it does not mean we cannot appreciate them in some sense. So that when Charles gets to Oxford, coming out of that dead world, that dead life, and meets Sebastian, and we get the first glimpse of them going off in the motor car with a basket of strawberries and a bottle of Chateau Perrier, which isn't a wine you've ever tasted, so don't pretend it's heaven with strawberries. After the 10 dinners of Aunt Philippa, it's glorious. It's wonderful. It's just absolutely glorious. And Charles is discovering life. Something that he has never known. And he speaks of it in that way. When he first gets invited to luncheon at Sebastian's, he's walking through the city, page 31, and says, "I went there uncertainly, for it was foreign ground, and there was a tiny priggish warning voice in my ear, which in the tones of Collins told me it was seemly to hold back. Don't go there. Don't go there." Now, of course, if he didn't go, we never take that first step that will eventually lead down the path that God intends him to travel. So that warning voice is really something quite different than Collins. "But I was in search of love in those days, and I went full of curiosity and the faint unrecognized apprehension that here at last I should find that low door in the wall, which others, I knew, had found before me, which opened on an enclosed and enchanted garden, which was somewhere, not overlooked by any window, in the heart of that gray city." It's seeking magic in the midst of grayness. The next sentence, Sebastian lived at Christ Church. That's his college, but that's also, in a way, that first step. Sebastian may be running from the faith. He may hate his mother and want to get away from it. But it's very clear that it is through Sebastian that Charles first is introduced to the faith. First comes to know the faith. There is no human attachment that he's known before that time. He tells his father when the note comes that something has happened to Sebastian, he must go to Brideshead. That wonderful description, he's some serious accident in Sebastian's life, he turns out to have tripped over a croquet hoop and broken a tiny bone in his foot, we learn. Nevertheless, he's going there and he says to his father, I have to go at once. Why exactly is your presence so necessary? You have no medical knowledge. You are not in holy orders. Do you hope for a legacy? Charles responds, I told you, he is a great friend. Well, Orm Herrick is a great friend of mine, but I should not go tearing off to his deathbed on a warm Sunday afternoon. Which, of course, is wonderfully funny, but what are we setting up? The deathbed. And the fact that this man wouldn't go to anybody's deathbed, not even that of his good friend. Not if it was a warm Sunday afternoon. Absolute selfishness. The absence of love. His son will break out of that dead gray home. And at the end, indeed, kneel by Lord Marchmain's bedside when Lord Marchmain is dying and utter a prayer, maybe his first. O God, if there is a God, forgive him his sins, if there is such a thing as sin. An inauthentic prayer, a stumbling prayer that God uses for authentic ends. Just a glorious moment, but it's already being prepared for. I should not go tearing off to his deathbed on a warm Sunday afternoon. It's brilliant. What comes into Charles's life? Some life. Some energy, a love, a false love, a romantic friendship that is in some ways inappropriate. And he himself says it. I was given a brief spell of what I had never known, a happy childhood. And he speaks of those days with Sebastian as a childhood because he never got a chance to be a child. And just romp in the joys of the world, which is what children should do. He had missed that. And though its toys were silk shirts and liqueurs and cigars and its naughtiness high in the catalog of grave sins, says the older Charles looking back and judging himself, there was something of nursery freshness about us that fell little short of the joy of innocence. And what he focuses on is the joy of discovering the world with Sebastian. Whether it is the joy of eating plover's eggs or going to Venice. And suddenly that world becomes a place to be lived in. Now, Sebastian, who is the center of book one, for all of his charm, for all of his delight, is a tortured soul. An absolutely tortured soul. If you remember, they head off right at the beginning of book one, and he's taken Hardcastle's car. And he said, well, I invited him to come with us, and I told him we'd leave at 10, but I figured if he wasn't up an hour early, he really wasn't interested. And off they go. But he says at that point, you know, I'm a very bad driver. And then, of course, we get the crack up in London at the time of Rex's party. And it's a little thing, but it's absolutely true. Sebastian cannot drive. Sebastian cannot find his way. Sebastian cannot guide himself through the world in any way. We could probably say he never had a father who taught him how to drive, because his father is gone. It is a character lacking direction and control. A bad driver. But at the same time that he's a bad driver, he also is willful, single-minded. Charles says at one point, Sebastian's life was governed by a code of such imperatives. I must have pillar box red pajamas. I have to stay in bed until the sun works round to the windows. I've absolutely got to drink champagne tonight. Now, it's witty, it's funny, it's willful. It's the willfulness of a child. And of course, Sebastian is still a child. He will not give up his childhood. He clings to his teddy bear. He clings to his teddy bear. Of course, he's named the teddy bear Aloysius, patron saint of children. And he will be watched over through the prayers of his mother. Okay? Through the prayers of his mother. He loves his nanny. When he goes to Brideshead, he wants to visit his nanny. That's the attachment. The day he goes out on the fox hunt and goes riding with them, his horse's name is Tinkerbell. And he's a Peter Pan figure who won't grow up. And again, it's part of his charm, but the fact is, it's unhealthy. And Cara makes clear when she's talking to Charles in Venice, that he drinks too much. And he doesn't drink the way that others drink. There is something wrong. I'm not going to go through, but you can run through this book. This is an idea I'll plant for you. And the next time you go through it, you can see it. Every time Sebastian is mentioned, there's discussion of shadows. The first time we go to Brideshead, it's this beautiful, glorious, sunny day. And we have the moment where indeed they drink, wine, they eat the strawberries, and they're lying there enjoying that sense of being timeless, out of time for an instant. But it's false. Just the place to bury a crock of gold, said Sebastian. I should like to bury something precious in every place where I've been happy. And then, when I am old and ugly and miserable, I could come back and dig it up and remember. And of course, that's what's going to happen to him exactly, except he can't come back. He won't come back. That day was the beginning of my friendship with Sebastian, and thus it came about that morning in June that I was lying beside him in the shade of the high elms, watching the smoke from his lips drift up into the branches, and the shade is already there. And the shadows just keep encroaching. The shadows keep coming in. When we go into his room, we find a room that is a jumble. It's a complete it makes no sense. Things don't go together. His room was filled with a strange jumble of objects, a harmonium in a Gothic case, an elephant's foot wastepaper basket, a dome of wax fruit, two disproportionately large Sèvres vases, frame drawings by Daumier. It is very similar to when we first go into Nanny Hawkins' room, which is a jumble of objects. He is in one sense imitating Nanny Hawkins, but those have been brought to her by her children, as they're called, and we have the sense she has raised those children. Again, it's a kind of jumble and things don't connect, but she is there, half drowsing, rosary beads in her hand, Sacred Heart on the wall, and she is, again, that Catholic influence on them when they were young. And remember where her room is. It's high up next to the dome. It's elevated again. It's above. It's above. And she's always there. During the war, Charles goes back and discovers she's still up there. And she still has the rosary beads in her fingers, in her hands. And she doesn't quite recognize him, but she's still there. And she can report on where Julie and Cordelia are, where Bridie is. She still knows where the children are. But it's very interesting. The one room that makes sense is Lady Marchmain's room. I'm on page 126. The enormous home, if you will, Brideshead Castle, loaded with works of art. I'll talk more about this tomorrow, actually. The talk I'm going to give tomorrow night is focusing on one specific subject, that is art and architecture, as it is used as a theme throughout the entire novel. It's everywhere. I won't go into it now, but let's just say we learn interesting things about the house itself. And Waugh is using that deliberately for a purpose, for a larger idea. But what we get is that it, too, is almost a palace of art. It's there for all the beautiful objects it contains. But it has been neglected by its owner. When they first go, in order to show the house, Sebastian has to open all the curtains and let the light in because huge sections of the house are closed off in darkness. But the house has a heart, and it is Lady Marchmain's room. If the father has deserted, what will preserve the children is the love of the mother. And in her room, the house has a heart. The room was all her own. She had taken it for herself and changed it so that entering, one seemed to be in another house. She had lowered the ceiling, and the elaborate cornice, which in one form or another graced every room, was lost to view. It's intimate. It's not highly decorated. The walls, once paneled in brocade, were stripped and washed blue and spotted with innumerable little watercolors of fond association. Simplicity, fond associations. The air was sweet with the fresh scent of flowers and musty potpourri. Her library in soft leather covers, well-read works of poetry and piety, filled a small rosewood bookcase. The chimney piece was covered with small personal treasures, an ivory Madonna, a plaster Saint Joseph, posthumous miniatures of her three soldier brothers. When Sebastian and I lived alone at Brideshead during that brilliant August, we had kept out of his mother's room. Because that's the Catholic heart of the house. And during those days when they are reveling in worldly delights, they don't go near the Catholic heart. But the Catholic heart is in the home, and it's Lady Marchmain's room. And that heart is always there. But that heart is pierced. I won't go through, elaborate all the references. Constantly, there are references associating Lady Marchmain with the seven dolors of Our Lady. The heart pierced with sorrow. And of course, her heart is pierced as she watches her husband go, Sebastian fall to pieces, Julia make the horrible marriage, and then dies with the cancer eating her away. She suffers. But constantly, the repeated question, who's going with me to chapel tonight? And off they go to do the rosary, to pray. And it's a tiny moment, but what we know is that she is constantly praying for that family, for those renegades, for those who have run. And as she prays, there is already the hope of a possible answer, though she does not live to see it. She says to Charles at one point, I prayed for you too in the night, she says. The two characters that we learn who pray for Charles are Lady Marchmain and Cordelia, who that first night they meet at the dinner table, says, well, maybe you really are an agnostic. She says, you know, I'll pray for you. And he says, oh, well, thank you. She says, well, I've got harder cases than you. it's wonderful. It's just, I've got Lloyd George and the Kaiser. She says, I can only give you a decade. It's just absolutely wonderful. And Olive Banks. He says, who's Olive Banks? Oh, she's a girl that got bumped from the from the school. The Reverend Mother read something she'd been writing and she was out the next day. But those two pray for Charles. And again, the prayers are answered. The prayers are answered. We have that sense of the power of prayer, but he does not blast it home. It's there. It's working. It's working quietly. We see its effects. We see that the prayer is efficacious by what happens to Charles at the end, and we don't really, I mean, it doesn't come home to us till the very end in terms of what has happened. Nevertheless, Lady Marchmain is human. She has that moment when she accuses him of being wicked, of being openly wicked, when he gives the money to Sebastian so Sebastian can leave the fox hunt and go off and get drunk. She says, how could you be so wicked? Did you hate us all the time? And then we learn she has a very bad conscience about it. It's one of the few times we see her do anything like that, and it haunts her. And of course, one reason that she feels guilty and changes her mind is that, of course, we learn she's not the only one who is supplying Sebastian. We learn later that Cordelia's been sneaking money to him too. In the same way, just a couple of quick words about Cordelia. She's named obviously for the character in King Lear, who is the truth teller. And she's the truth teller throughout. I would also point out in curiosity, I said earlier that this is a book without fathers. This is also a book without children. Nothing's handed down. Julia has one child who dies. The child dies during childbirth. Sebastian obviously has no children. Cordelia never marries. Bridie marries Mrs. Muspratt and gets a family, but has no children of his own. And yet, curiously, notice the only two who do have any children at all that we hear of, Bridie, who we assume, eccentric as he is, will be a good stepfather to those children. And of course, we learn about the six black Cordelias in Africa, where she talks about, if he'd give her some money, she could get another black Cordelia. And Charles says, there's nothing about your religion that would surprise me. And that's when he learns, Sebastian says, she even made a novena for her pig. But it is that wonderful sense that God works everywhere. God works everywhere. It's one of the great memories I have when I first came into the traditional church is going back one after Mass one Sunday at St. Athanasius to talk with Father Ringrose. And a little girl was ahead of me, and she had this tiny hamster in a tiny cage. And she was going back to have Father bless her hamster. And he pulled out the little book, and he read the prayer, and he did the blessing. And I remember thinking, this is Catholic. This is Catholic. When that little girl left, she was beaming. And that little animal had been sanctified. And she knew it. So we laugh at Cordelia making her novena for her pig, but that's Catholic at core, because God is there guarding everything we love, whether it be Cordelia's pig or Lady Marchmain's prayers and sacrifices for her whole family. Of a different order, obviously, but that love and concern is everywhere, and that is not Protestant. That is not modern. That is filled with joy and love, and it is not gray and drab and dead and dull. And the life in this book comes from that kind of vision. Cordelia is the truth teller. Very quickly, some moments where we see it. I mentioned the first one where she simply says, you know, you are an agnostic. I'll pray for you. And we get that sense. Her prayer is obviously efficacious in a wonderful way. She's the one who goes up to see how Sebastian is that awful night when he's too drunk to come down. And Charles says, oh, he's ill, he has a cold, it's come on worse. And she says, oh, but she wants to go care for him. She runs up, she comes down and says, I think he's drunk. You know, it's just not knowing it. The truth comes out. And it turns out to be a good in its way. By the way, that's the night. That's the night that Lady Marchmain is reading from the Father Brown story. And from which we get the title for book two, A Twitch Upon the Thread. For I caught him with an unseen hook and an invisible line that will allow him to travel to the ends of the earth and come back with a twitch upon the thread. And it's an image of God with each human soul. He's got us. We can break that line and run where we want. But that hook is in us. That thread is being pulled. Well, I don't know, but I think he's very drunk, she said. Cordelia, her mother says. But perhaps the most striking moment, another one just springs to mind. Julia says she's going to marry Rex anyway outside the church. Cordelia says, I hate you, Julia, and rushes weeping from the room. And then we find out the morning of that shabby wedding at the little Protestant church, Cordelia shows up at Julia's room weeping, gives her a gift, and hopes she'll always be happy. Just that love, that is feminine, It's something else that has vanished from the world. Page 334, crucial one, and I will come back to this later. She is talking with her father. He is running through his life at the end of the novel, remembering what he's done. There used to be a chaplain until there used to be a chaplain until the war, you remember him. I was too young. Then I went away, left her in the chapel praying. It was hers. It was the place for her. I never came back to disturb her prayers. They said we were fighting for freedom. I had my own victory. Was it a crime? I think it was, Papa, says Cordelia to her father. Crying to heaven for vengeance? Is that why they've locked me in? And suddenly the guilt is on him. And suddenly he is hit with guilt because his daughter has spoken the truth. Was that a crime? He asks rhetorically. We fought for freedom. I had mine. So I got to go off and be free. False definition of freedom, of course, but nevertheless. Typical modern definition of freedom. I got to do whatever I want to do. It's willfulness, like Sebastian. I got to do what I want to do. Was that a crime? Was it a crime? I think it was, Papa. If you've seen the TV series, Olivier's face at that moment is unbelievable as he looks at the actress playing Cordelia after she says that. His eyes become the size of small saucers as it lands on him, the import of those words. Only a great actor could have a moment like that. And of course, I don't find it accidental. If we're talking about providence, that the greatest actor of the century ends up playing Lord Marchmain in the TV version of that. It's stunning. I'll say more about the TV version tomorrow night. Very quick word about Bridie, and then I'm through the family except for Julia, whom I will get to tomorrow. Bridey is also a truth teller, but he doesn't quite know when he's telling the truth. Hence Bridey's bombshells. Bridey has no social sense at all. Keeps putting his foot in it. And it's the reason why, probably, he didn't have a vocation. He just can't quite connect with other people. Good man. But so eccentric that his life finally comes down to Mrs. Muspratt and Max Matchboxes. Curious habits, no real sense of what he's going to do in the world. He's absolutely adrift. But again, he sparks through a moment of truth the resolution of the novel when he says to Julia, when Julia says, why didn't you invite her up here to spend the night? Well, I couldn't do that, she's a good Catholic woman. And whether you choose to live in sin with Rex or Charles, or whatever is going on with your menage, I've never inquired, but she certainly would not come and spend the night here. And it's a moment of truth, simple truth. And Charles says, Bridie, what a terrible thing to say to Julia. She says, well, she knows it's true. And that's it, simple truth. She was raised Catholic. She knows truth. She may not live it, but she knows truth. Bridie, the more you look at this book, Bridie becomes more interesting. He's really quite a charming character. At first, you just think he's weird. But there's that sense that eccentric characters at first put you off by their eccentricity, and then once you get used to that, you warm to their character. Because at least they're real. There are things about them that define them. I think this is a good stopping place. I will pick up tomorrow night with Julia, which will take us into part two, lead us to the end. But as I said, the bulk of tomorrow night, I want to look at the whole question of art and architecture, how the house is built, and what we learn about art in this book, because on one level, it's about art and the glory of art and the failure of art, just as surely as love that is not divine love can fail. I've got a few minutes. I'll take questions from anything that I said tonight. Yes.
Yes, Doctor. In the revised edition,
yes,
the books are rearranged.
Yes.
How does this rearrange the plan?
Very much so. And let me say a word about this. I don't think a study's ever been done of this. I am very suspicious of artists who go back and revise their works some years later. Very suspicious, unless it's a wholesale recreation. Verdi completely redoing Simone Boccanegra from top to bottom, and you get a new work. What you had here was Waugh went back and revised this because he had changed over the 16 years after it was written, and the older artists came to look at the younger book and decide there were flaws there. Well, there probably were of some kind looking at it in retrospect. The other thing he did, and I will talk about this tomorrow, is he made some severe cuts in what he called passages that were overwritten and said that because of the deprivations of war, there was too much discussion in the book of elaborate discussion of food and drink and elaboration of that sort of thing, things that they didn't have at the time. I think it's an integral part of the book, and I think he made a mistake. So mine is probably a minority voice here, but I much prefer the original version for the very simple reason I think it is better structured, and I think there are artistic reasons for what, I will use his word, excesses, but I will try to defend them tomorrow night. Yes?
Sorry to follow up.
That's fine.
It seems that, wasn't it so that the original book structure was what was reproduced in the revision, and so that in the manuscript, books are arranged as in revision.
But what you had before the thing went to press, he gave final approval. And there is that sense. There is that sense. I think intuitively, and again, I would say much of what an artist does happens intuitively. And it seems to me that this, the way it first appeared, which he read the final, signed off on, there were some changes made. But it seems to me that the structure as it stands here makes much more sense than the later three-part. Yeah. One of my favorite composers, I don't know if you know him, Anton Bruckner, who was so uncertain about his own skills. If a friend came by and said, I don't like that third movement, he'd rewrite it. And as a result, there is version after version after version of Bruckner symphonies. And almost without exception, I think the originals are better. Almost without exception. It is, and he would revise sometimes 5, 10, 15 years later. He's a changed man at that point. He can't really know the work in the same way as when it was produced. Again, let me make clear, this is a matter of taste, and mine is a minority opinion. But I do have very real problems with artists later going back and making that kind of revision in earlier work. I rarely think it improves the work. Yeah. Yes?
I was just wondering what it's called Diary of the Nobody is about.
Yeah, it's a Victorian novel, and I forget the author's name. But basically about, I would simply call it a gray personality-less character. And in a strange way, it's a reflection on the kind of man Charles could have become if he had continued in that direction. I've never read the book, so I couldn't say. But it does tie in that way. The title, in a sense, tells it all. It's about a man who's a blank, who barely exists, who simply isn't there. And that, I think, is what Charles was heading toward. Had he not met Sebastian and then the Flight family. Yes?
There's a section page 86, where they're talking about it's hard to be a Catholic.
Oh, yes.
What does that mean when he gives a quote of St. Augustine there? I was told the quote was wrong. It's, oh, God, make me good.
But not yet.
I heard it was, oh, God, make me chaste.
It's essentially the same idea. It's essentially the same idea. And what Sebastian is doing, again, he knows what he's doing is wrong. He knows what he is doing is wrong. He doesn't want to change. He has no desire to change. It's part of his willfulness. By the way, please notice where we last see him and where he will probably die. He's in Carthage. So if he quotes St. Augustine then, he ends up at Carthage. Interesting little touch. It's willful. It's sheer willfulness. And it's what he's running from all along. But it means he knows his Augustine, even if it is a slight misquotation. Yeah. Yeah. It's loaded with little moments like that. Countless, I didn't get to them tonight, the countless discussions of the Catholic faith. And they just pop in as conversation. And Charles becomes exasperated, saying to Bridie at one point, you know, there you go talking about religion again. And Bridie says, well, I never left it. Just, you know, it's a subject that comes up naturally, doesn't it? And Charles says, well, it never has before with me. But that, again, is a mark of the absolute emptiness of his life. We'll look at some of them tomorrow night. Because there is the sense. It's planted all the way through there. And at the beginning, you know, Sebastian is going to Mass at the beginning. Regularly, and wishes it weren't true, he says at one point. He wishes it weren't true. Somehow it would make things easier for him. But that's just at the beginning. It is all transformed by the end. Yes?
I think it's Jasper who gives Charles, at the very beginning of the whole
first
frame, he gives him a portrait of the whole family. What is the importance of that? And it was very striking. And it kind of gave you a bad taste for the finding these characters, learning about them. So,
yeah, cousin Jasper.
I think that's who it was who was giving him. He had he knew the family beforehand, so he was warning Charles.
Oh! It's cousin Jasper. Talks against Sebastian and Anthony Blanche. It's Anthony Blanche who gives the rundown of the family. Highly critical. And what you find with Anthony Blanche is a strange mixture of some accuracy and gross inaccuracy. He talks about the family charm, which he says can blight art. And there is something of that seductive charm that both Sebastian and Julia exert on Charles. He talks about Lord Marchmain running off. And how he's been cast off, and the way in which he is viewed as if he's done something terribly wrong. Of course he has. But the most inaccurate is his description of Lady Marchmain, and he calls her a bloodsucker. completely inaccurate. But what we're going to discover, and I'll get to this tomorrow night, Anthony Blanch is always seems to be dead on accurate when talking about art and can't be believed on any other subject. He simply makes things up. But he is a truth teller in only one area, and that's art. And we get our first rundown of the family from him. And in fact, Charles then goes back and checks with Sebastian and said, did you know Anthony at school? He says, well, yeah, but I didn't know him well. And then asks a couple of other things, and it seems that maybe he was even lying directly, saying things that are not true at all. But this is a world of lies. It's a fabric of lies all the way through until finally one can cut through them and come to that truth. Yes?
I don't know if it's just me, but it seems like the character of Charles Ryder is not very endearing. And I thought maybe the author might be trying to give the reader a sense of detachment from things that don't last.
There is a sense. He is not pretty. We see things through him. But he is, if you will, that unformed figure on which everything acts. But part of it is the contrast between Charles and these people around him who are so clearly drawn. But I think, again, part of that comes out of Waugh's own sense of his own vacancy before he got out in the world and came to be developed. And Charles does not... there is something in Charles because we do know he is an artist and he has produced some real art. But let's face it, when does he begin, in a sense, to become fully real? Not until he suffers his real disaster. And that is the break with Julia that brings him into the church. So in one sense, he's come alive fully just as the book ends. Everything is just getting him to that point. If you will, he is on the at that point, the beginning of faith. And I just think it's a truth. The personality cannot fully develop until it comes into the church and begins receiving the sacraments. I don't think it's possible. In that sense, there's a reason for him not quite being there.
Do you think Sebastian had a vocation and that he was fleeing from it? Because I know in the end, he ends up in the monastery.
He does end up in the monastery. It was possible, but he has so many problems. And he is, as he himself says at one point, something so wrong inside that he couldn't have acted on it. It's not possible. And yet, that's what's drawing him, and that's where he ends up, but at one remove. And we'll look at that tomorrow, because we do get a final vision of him. We get a sense, and Cordelia tells us, so we assume that will be what happens. She speculates, but I think we're supposed to take that as a valid speculation. Yeah, Patrick?
Is Rex a form of Hooper?
Rex is a moneyed political form of Hooper. Yep. We'll look. Oh, I've skipped over Rex. We've got to do Rex. Rex, of course, king. And he is the one who's going to triumph in worldly terms out of all of it. Yeah. But he's Hooper triumphant. But Rex is really there just to serve Hooper and make a world for Hooper to grow and prosper in. And it's horrifying. That world of money and politics and power, but that's what's out there now. Rex is triumphant. Yeah. Julia says, a little piece of a man pretending to be whole. And that's what he is, and that's what the world is populated with now. That's the horrible thing, yes.
Any accident that his child died in the Fort Worth?
There is a sense of it, although in a curious way we hear it from Julia, and she suffers terribly from that loss. But again, it's the sense, what could come from such a marriage? How is it possible? What could be there? What could be there? Yes.
Why doesn't Cordelia have a vocation?
Ask God. And I don't mean to be flippant. I don't mean to be flippant. But there is, no, she seems not to. And it is a source, it's very clearly a kind of sorrow for her, and yet she says at the end of book one, I hope I have a vocation. And then explains to Charles what it means. But she clearly comes to feel that she doesn't. But yet she goes right on, even having, I love it, and says, do you think I have another one of those luscious meringues? It's just sort of, she accepts God's will, whatever it is. And if she doesn't have a vocation, well, then I'll have another meringue. And again, that's part of the delight in the character. She is one loves Cordelia. To my mind, the two greatest characters in all of English literature are both named Cordelia. I clearly did that. You'll notice there are references to King Lear throughout the book. And why? Because of the father who fails his family. Lear breaks up his kingdom and destroys it, and Lord Marchmain flees from his responsibilities. They both have daughters named Cordelia who are truth tellers. The difference is Lear is a tragedy and Brideshead ends as a comedy. There is a sense of hope, regeneration, renewal at the end. But he's working with some of those parallels. He is using King Lear throughout this book. Yes, it's another little sub-pattern running through it. Yes. Thank you. I'll continue with this tomorrow night.